This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
I'm Kelly McComb.
I'm Ramya Muthan, and you're about to embark on the complete Kelly and Company podcast experience.
It's full octane Kelly and Ramya with all the fixins.
Live from the Accessible Media Studios, this is Kelly and Company. Entertainment, lifestyle, and great conversation. It's AMI Audio's on-air community, and everyone's invited. And now, the big man himself, Kelly McDonald.
Thanks for being with us on Kelly and Company. Ladies and gentlemen, we're here every day, 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Thanks a lot for assembling. Tomorrow, Rummy, I actually am going to spend some time with the gang at the Neutral Zone. They begin at 4 p.m. Eastern. And I get to be a part of the show to talk a little baseball. I absolutely love this time of the year. I love October because all the sports kind of get going. And I'm not really a big hockey follower. I've done more this year, well, even last year, than I've done in more recent years, even though that was the first sport I really got into as a kid, along with baseball. They were my two sports as a kid. Now I've moved on to the baseball and basketball kind of thing, liking because I find the Blue Jays exciting and potentially really exciting. But it's nice to get a chance to talk with a gang of people over there on the Neutral Zone, the panel, about sports when it comes to the things that I'm comfortable with. I've been asked before, would you like to be a guy that works at a sports radio station? And my answer to them is, oh, I'd love to be if I had the smarts, if I had the knowledge, if I retained the stuff from my past. If you know, I'll listen to sports hosts talk. Yeah, in 1998, there was an event in the World Series, and they know, I remember when that happened, when he dropped the ball, and I'm listening in saying, no. I don't remember that. I don't remember what mistake somebody made last year unless it was really a big deal was made out of it.
Sure. Yeah, because you and I have talked about, you know, the people who come on our show to talk sports from some of the networks, as well as our very own Brock Richardson and Jeff Ryman. And when they come on, you've even told me, like, they're just absolutely on it when it comes to sports, all kinds of sports, not just like any particular ones. But, you know, they keep it. They retain the information. They know what to pull up in conversation. And I'm just like, oh, wow. So there's that. What would you call that? I guess,
well,
you know.
I think it's along with the passion. Like, I know sometimes you think,
sure,
well, I'm a host of a sports show, but you're also a fan. You're passionate about it. And again, one could talk about Mark Cullen. He's passionate about gardens and plant life and how to put together, and that's not every single facet of the plant world, but it's what the person really is into, what part of it. And when a person talks that way, and I've always said, as someone who's into theater, I really like verbiage. Sometimes people will write a script and I'm like, whoa, I'm lost here on some of this dialogue. Mm-hmm. But when you hear people talking and describing and using those rich words, I think it's great. And that lends itself to sports. Even if you don't like sports, you don't understand the slang of it, I always find it really fun to hear people use the diverse words and you stop and say, wow. Like if you had to actually write down what they were saying and read it, looked at it, said, like, what the heck? And everything has that language that when you really look at it, boy, that's kind of cool. Whatever business you're in or whatever industry or hobby.
Yeah, that's true, actually, because, I mean, you could be into like a very specific sport and that is your niche, right? That's what people call on you to talk about. And that's where people know they can turn to this person. But then there's just like the reason why you love sports overall and the things that you retain because of your own passions towards it. So interesting.
And that's anything, any hobby,
we've
had people, when we do collections and hobbies, some of the things people say and their passion for it brings out that language and always a fun thing. Like I say, joining the gang this Friday on the Neutral Zone for a little bit in the second half of the show. So if you have time, stick around after Kelly and Company. But let's get through today's show and see what's coming up on the program. Fern Lulham is going to highlight Sightsavers, an international organization that works to both cure and prevent blindness in developing nations.
We're learning learning about Halton Healthcare because they are piloting a blind square project to create a more accessible experience by ensuring that people with sight loss have the opportunity to navigate the hospital safely and independently. And we're actually going to be speaking with Jack McCormick, organizational development consultant of Halton Healthcare, about how the project is going.
We've been working hard to try to promote some of the podcasts that are available via AMI Audio. And the roundtable today does not disappoint. The host of the Low Vision Moments podcast, Jenny Bovert, she joins us a little later on. That'll be an hour two of the program. We'll get into some good conversation and chat there for sure. Well, Germany's health minister says his country will hold bilateral talks with Russia on whether an order of Russia's Sputnik V coronavirus vaccine makes sense for them.
Germany's health minister Jens Spahn saying his country is considering obtaining doses of the Russian Sputnik vaccine, though any final agreement will depend on Russia providing key data to the European Medicines Agency. Spahn added the European Union would not be placing orders for Russia's vaccine on behalf of its member countries as it did with other companies. This comes as Europe continues to struggle with a third wave of COVID-19, as well as vaccine shortages and delays. Inez de la Quatera, ABC News, Paris.
And this is what you wonder. I mean, we've talked about Canada not necessarily being able to produce our own, whether we understand how that's possible, how come it couldn't be made. The vaccines that are out there here, facility-wise, we know some plans are ahead for that to be happening, because obviously we can say, oh, well, I wish we could have done that now. Well, we'll be able to in time. And there'll be time, because things aren't, you know, going away completely anytime soon, Rum. But we've got four over here that we're going to be able to utilize in this country. And you think of other parts of the world where maybe they're not there, or maybe they're not comfortable with one of them. Or do you trust some of the others that other countries have come up with that are not on our radar? It's an interesting thing to think about when we're right now just wanting anything to help us.
Yeah, and I have been hearing lots of talk about we need to be helping the developing nations for the vaccine stages that we're at right now, right? Because this thing is global. So there's a focus on what happens in our country and in our neighboring countries, and to kind of assimilate ourselves with or compare ourselves to. But there's also just that everyone is going through it. And if they over there can't get what we have, and we have, like you said, four vaccines that are in different stages and different progress, but still those kind of options. And if other countries don't, that does make a dent in how we move forward with this pandemic and how we kind of think of treatment and stages at, because you can't, Kels, like you can't have one country who's doing so well because of border closures and because of different kinds of ways that the government is dealing with, and plus the vaccine, and then other countries where people are just absolutely dying and getting ill from this vaccine, from this virus, because they don't have the methods and the means to get the vaccinations.
Or to make sure they have the commitments to get, especially when anything rolls to a trickle, availability or dries up altogether. So anxious to see where they go with that one and what else is out there around the world as we read and hear about. Neil Diamond's long-awaited theatrical musical will be debut next year in Boston.
That musical, based on the life and songs of Neil Diamond, now has a name and a premiere date. A Beautiful Noise, named after the legendary singer-songwriter's 1976 album, will have its world premiere in Boston, June 21st of next year. That works, given Boston's love of Sweet Caroline. It's been played in the eighth inning of every Red Sox baseball game for the last two decades. Christopher Watson, ABC News.
And be honest, it's played everywhere else, too. Everyone else has stolen that and taken a great song that my mother absolutely loved and just... Anyway, it'll be great. Congratulations on that being opened. Coming up in the next segment of the program, three feature-length adventures involving murder and intrigue have been dramatized by BBC Radio, and Audible has released these as a collection in one audiobook. Michael Fair, he's going to offer his impressions after this break. Well, you can find us out there on Twitter. Rumya is at AllRams with a Z. I'm at AMI Kelly Mac. Always nice to have a conversation with you out there. If you want to send a question, query, or any concern, or just want to just have some fun, you know, and know some stuff about scheduling or anything like that, feedback at AMI.ca. Great way to do that. And also, don't forget the Accessible Media Inc. Facebook page. Some good conversations and content out there in which to take in. Rumya Muth and Kelly McDonald, we are the hosts of the program. Thanks for being with us.
Well, Kels, every Thursday, I had to remember what day it was, Michael Fair joins us for a little bit of everything. And today we're getting into audio entertainment. Let's bring him on.
Hi, I'm Mike Fair. iPhones, iPods, and iPads are everywhere, and they're doing great things for the blind. We explore all that, plus audio entertainment, dramas, podcasts, internet radio, and games. We share it all on Kelly & Company.
Mike, let's follow up Easter and the Easter long weekend with an audio trip to 11th century England. So, brother, am I saying this right, Cadfael?
Yeah, it's Cadfael. It's Cadfael, Welsh,
okay.
Actually. So, yeah.
Okay. So, brother Cadfael awaits us in his herbalist workshop, and three feature-length adventures involving murder and intrigue have been dramatized by BBC Radio in the early 90s. And the cool thing is, Audible, our friends over at Audible, have released this as a collection in one audiobook. So you're going to offer us your impressions because you've listened to all three of these stories. First of all, who is Brother Cadfael? Tell us about this.
Well, he is a creation of an author named Alice Peters, who wrote, it's a long book series. But there must be at least 20 books in this series. And it's very famous. Brother Cadfael is his fictional detective. And he is a monk skilled in herbology, so he's a herbalist. And before becoming a monk, he was in the Crusades. He was a soldier and a sailor. So he's coming into monastic life, you know, in his later years, 40-plus kind of age. So he's done a lot. He's traveled. He's gained a lot of worldly knowledge. And now he's decided to forswear violence and basically go and lead a monastic life using what, you know, his skills, especially herbalism, to maintain, help the monks, help the townspeople, keep healthy and keep a stock of herbs that he grows in his own garden. And he has a workshop at this monastery.
How fun. I mean, when you talk about the herbs and the role they must play in this one, we'll get into that. Does he have a companion like Sherlock Holmes did with Watson?
Well, not really in the same sort of constant sense. He has a lot of friends. He's made a lot of good impressions on people. So, you know, the people around him will step into that role for times. Hugh Barringer is probably the closest. He's the deputy sheriff of Shrewsbury, where this monastery is. And so he will often ask for Brother Cadfael's advice and also get him to accompany him on various things. And I presume that continues throughout the other books.
Okay, so let's go through the three stories then, starting with the first one, Monk's Hood. What's this one about?
Well, this is where we are introduced in this drama set to the character, and it's a good beginning because it doesn't assume that you've read any of the books that might precede this. So this is a story where we meet him in his priory, and he's in the assembly in the morning, and the abbot of his priory is being sent away because they've just been involved in a bit of a civil war. And it's finally reached Shrewsbury, and the abbot hasn't exactly backed the winning side, and now his loyalty is in question. So the abbot has to ride off, leaving a stricter fellow in charge, Brother Robert, kind of an ambitious underling. And so there's trouble brewing there. No one really likes his style. Brother Cadfael is sort of a gentler soul, and you see that in how he treats his apprentice. Over the time, he tries to sort of have it a little softer, but he basically the story involves a family that is decided to bequeath all of their wealth to the monastery in exchange for the ability to live out the rest of their days as guests of the monastery. So they move in. The documents aren't sealed yet, and they won't be now because the prior has had to leave, and they need to sort of resolve who is the actual head of the abbey before that can happen. So that's left open. This family now is in has moved in very quickly, and there's kind of a little tension there. To add to that, the head of the family is soon murdered by herbs, which can only be gotten from this Brother Catfile's workshop. So now everyone's under suspicion. It might be advantageous to the monastery. You know, members of the family, maybe didn't like him. So the law has to get involved, and we get this strapping young sergeant who doesn't really think too kindly of Brother Cadfile's machinations as he tries to help everyone get through this crisis and figure out who really did the murder. And add to all that, there's a woman that is part of this family. The widow of this family is a woman that he might have married had life gone differently. They were betrothed at one time, but then he left to go to the Crusades. And she, of course, found another partner. And so that complicates his life as well. So it's a really good, you know, this is what Brother Catfile is like when his motives are questioned, when there's, you know, room for suspicion, and what will he do? How far will he bend rules and everything to help, you know, any of these people, right? So it's a really good opening story.
Sounds like it too, when still trying to do what's right and sticking with your own conscience of things that are part of the nonviolence, the whole things that he has given up in the way he wants to handle things. So what about the next story that you've got here for us, Virgin in the Ice?
Virgin in the Ice is basically there was a noble brother and sister, and they were being protected in another abbey that came under attack because they're still troubled times. They're right near the Welsh border, and they're still very unsettled. You know, the civil war is still kind of fresh. And so the monastery is under attack. They flee because the sister is kind of headstrong and decides that this is the right way of doing things rather than trusting that the abbey will be able to protect them. They go out into the freezing cold. It's winter. It's icy. It's dangerous. And they ended up basically getting lost out there. And Brother Catfile and others are hunted. So their enemies are hunting them. Their friends are hoping to find them first, especially with the Benedictine order. They want to, you know, their honor is at stake. They've vowed to protect this couple of noble people. And the pressure is on to find them before something dire happens. And eventually they get found, but it's a bit problematic because there's another thing that is found. Unfortunately, there's a woman buried in the ice, and this starts a mystery. Who is this woman? Is she the daughter that they're supposed to protect, or is she someone else? And they have to figure that out and how she died. And so Brother Catfile sort of gets involved in all of this. It's another one of these multi-threaded stories. All of these stories kind of do this. They have like a number of threads running through them. And it's a good formula. There's usually two or three different things that sort of formulate these. And they're really nicely put together.
Hmm. Are they in the order they're supposed to? If you want to say supposed to be, is whether you could listen to them out of order or not, do they appear to you to be in a specific order?
Well, I think the order that they chose seems to, I get the sense that it brings, we see Brother Catfile kind of from the beginning, we're sort of introduced when things are a bit shaky. Now he's sort of in more of his, he's not under suspicion. He's more sort of in his stride, I guess. And the third one is a bit tougher for him, and there might be a hint that it's farther along. I'm not sure of the order in the book series that these are actually in. I haven't really gotten to reading the books yet, And so, but there, it's a good, it's, it works as an arc. Like you do get a sense of now that this is later, the third story has the sheriff caught, and the deputy Hugh Barringer, who's been sort of a loyal, person for Brother Cadfael to turn to over the course of these stories. He's now in this difficult position of his superior is now in jeopardy, has to be rescued from the Welsh. And of course, Brother Cadfael is Welsh, knows the customs, knows the language. So he, of course, gets involved to try and help, you know, win this, you know, resolve all these difficulties. And they're trying to recover from the civil wars and sort of find a way to coexist. So a lot of tension, a lot of intrigue. It's a neat third story to wrap up this set of stories.
And that one's Dead Man's Ransom for the title. So what about the pacing? Do you think that the pacing and timing of the dramas work for how long they are?
This is designed to be, each of these were designed as a series to be listened to over a 5-day week and 30-minute episodes, right? So it's divided up into these 30-minute chunks, and each story is basically 2.5 hours long. So you're getting like 7 hours of drama, and I think it works pretty well for the pacing of the stories. There's long enough for you to get to know the characters, you know, for you to really care about how it's resolved, particularly if you spread it out over 5 days. I kind of binged. They're basically 2.5 hour stories.
Okay.
And it works pretty well, I think.
Okay, well, let's take a listen to the sample provided to us by Audible.
From the darkness of his corner, Brother Cadfael regarded Prior Robert Pennant, ivory of face and silver of hair and brows, ever erect and stately, as if he already balanced the abbot's mitre for which he yearned. Beside him, Abbot Heribert, old and gentle and anxious, seemed to diminish even further.
And who has been guilty of this indiscipline?
One of the novices. The boy was heard singing in the cloisters while he was employed copying a prayer of St. Augustine.
Singing?
A secular song, Father Abbot, and one concerning a woman. It purports to be the lament of a Christian pilgrim imprisoned by the Saracens. He comforts himself by hugging to his breast a gift given to him by his lover at parting. Her chemise.
What? Look at Brother Jerome. He's practically having convulsions. I think he'd forgotten that women exist.
Quiet. I know that song.
What?
It's beautiful.
Really cool. Mike, we're going to have to be wrapping up, so let us know, is it worth the credit on Audible or the $24.99?
Absolutely, yeah. They're really well put together dramas, and certainly worth the credit. $24.99 might be a little steep, but they're good dramas, and certainly if you want an interesting mix of religion and murder mystery, you can't go wrong with Brother Cadfael.
Okay, great. And just a heads up that there aren't any extras that come with this one, because sometimes you feature things that do. Appreciate it, Mike.
Yeah, pleasure.
Okay, so you can find the Brother Cadfael BBC Radio collection of 3 full cast dramas on Audible. They're doing such great things over there, acquiring and creating. And you get all 3 dramas for $24.81. I lied, it's a little less. Or 1 Audible credit if you are a member.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, sounds good. Quality was nice. Coming up next, Fern Lullum highlights Sightsavers, an international organization that works to both cure and prevent blindness in developing nations. We'll talk to her after this break. Thanks for hanging out with us here on Kelly and Company. Wherever you are around the world, really nice to know you're out there. Always wonderful to hear from you, whichever way you choose to do so. And remember, we're here weekdays from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. midnight, and 5 a.m. in the morning for the repeats of the program. Kelly MacDonald at the home studio in London, Ontario. Rumya Muthan at their home studio in Toronto. Boy, we're pushing it when it comes to the temperature. Some would say, wow, we're almost in summer. So somebody's hit fast forward, Rum.
Yeah, it feels like it. I mean, the kind of heat that I'm feeling and the fans going and windows open, it might as well be summer. Sunshine.
Oh, yeah, and sunshine. And Rum, a big fan of the sunshine. You know what? I don't mind it warm a little with a bit of cloud. So I'm good that way, either way. But folks, get it right. He's not complaining. It just sort of sounds like it. Anyway, enough of that. Let's bring on our friend from the UK, Fern Lullum.
What's on your mind? I'm Fern Lullum from the UK, and whether serious, silly, or somewhere in between, I've got you covered. Let's face it, the most effective therapy is a chat with your bestie.
Fern always seems to be able to bring us some stuff. You look at it and say, wow, this looks interesting. These people seem really like they're out there doing some great things, and I love hearing about this kind of stuff. So we welcome Fern back to the program, and today we're going to be talking about an international charity that works to treat and prevent blindness in developing countries and to create more inclusive societies for the blind and other disabled people out there. Thanks, Fern.
Yes, indeed. So today I'm going to be talking about Sight Savers and the remarkable work that they do. And just one example of that is that between 1950 and 2018, they had supported no less than 7.3 million cataract operations.
Wow.
That's a lot of cataracts.
Wow. Wow. And that's something to really say, like, hey, and stand proud over. Tell us a little bit more about their history.
Right. So it all started with a man called John Wilson in 1931. And he was blinded by an explosion during a school chemistry lesson. And that kind of sounds familiar to my school chemistry lessons, explosions. He went on to study law at Oxford University here in the UK. And then he got a job with the National Institute for the Blind. And then in 1946, he went on a tour of Africa and the Middle East, and was shocked to see the scale of blindness and the condition of blind people were living in. So shocked was he, in fact, that he decided that he's got to do something about it.
Okay, well, he sounds like a remarkable person. This sounds like it's going to be a remarkable story. So what was John Wilson inspired to do then when he saw this?
Well, he certainly didn't do things by halves, our John Wilson. Oh, no. In 1950, he founded the British Empire Society for the Blind, and that's the organisation that we now know as Sight Savers. So in its first year, the society formed organisations for blind people in six countries. That's a good first year for a charity.
Wow. Yeah, I guess so, man. You kind of made sure he had a day or two off a week, I'm sure. Right. Obviously, a lot of determination and a man very ready to make his mark in supporting the blind community. So how did things progress from there, Fern?
Well, I think one of the things that shaped John Wilson's work was this survey done in West Africa in 1953, and that showed that 80% of blindness was either preventable or curable. So I think that that must have kind of convinced him the massive scope that there were for things to be improved.
Yeah, isn't that an interesting way to think about it? I mean, the first thing I thought was, then I probably don't know 80% of the type of blindnesses out there.
Right,
so it's a remarkable statistic. Can you give us an example of an eye condition that Sight Savers are tackling?
Well, one of the main conditions that causes problems is called river blindness, and that's because it's spread by a bite of an infected fly that they live near the rivers in these places. And so if this infection caused by these bites spreads to the eyes, it can then lead to irreversible sight loss.
Just amazes me because depending where you are in the world, you're going to have your leading conditions of anything, I guess. But you could so much be led down that garden path of, oh, well, I'm here in Canada, and the big things are this eye condition, that eye condition. But how big a problem, Fern, is this condition?
Yeah, it's very big. So 205 million people are at risk of getting this condition. So it's on a huge scale. And 20.9 million are actually infected. Most of these people live in sub-Saharan Africa, and 1.1 million people worldwide are blind because of this very disease.
Mm. Wow. Okay, those are obviously shocking numbers. Can you tell us about the work that SightSavers is doing to tackle this?
Yeah, so one of the main ways that they're doing this is by administration of antibiotics. So indeed, in 2017, SightSavers announced the distribution of their 1 billion treatment for people affected by tropical diseases like river blindness, the one that I just mentioned there. Mm-hmm. This was for a 7-year-old girl called Dorcas living in Nigeria.
Fern, a little earlier, you mentioned cataracts. What help is being given on those?
Well, although cataract surgery is common, and, you know, a lot of people will know about it, a lot of people know people who have had it, and, you know, it's quite easy to perform, resources in these developing countries for cataracts can be quite scarce. So since 1950, SightSavers have trained more than 1,000 surgeons to perform cataract operations, which is amazing.
Yeah, it is. And like you said, and we were talking about this earlier in the show as well, when it came to the COVID-19 vaccine, we got to think about all the countries out there and the kinds of resources that they have access to, or in this case, don't have access to. So it's clear that the organization has done some incredible work to treat and prevent blindness that is acceptable and available. But we know that they also work to make societies more inclusive for blind people. So tell us more about that part.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a well-established fact that there are links between disability and poverty. So generally speaking, disabled people find it harder to get work. And so, they have less income as a result. And it's a vicious circle in that way. So one of the things that SightSavers do to provide a vocational training, and they will also work with employers to get to make sure that people can get opportunities for employment for blind and other disabled people. So they're really helping them to get that experience and then go on and work with employers to encourage them to give people a chance.
Yeah. Well, and I guess that does more than just provide more income.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've talked about this before on the show, and I think most disabled people in any part of the world would say that having a job improves the way that you feel about yourself and your place in society. And I think that when disabled people are seen by others in work or taking part in sports, your favorite, Kelly, it does do so much for normalizing disability and helps to show that our similarities to non-disabled people far outweigh our differences. At the end of the day, we all want to feel worthy and valuable and like we have a place in society and that we're useful. You know, everyone wants that, don't they?
Yeah. And somewhere to go every day when you get up, you have your tasks that you do, whether it's a job, whether it's taking care of a household or whatever. It's that confidence to be able to do. It's not all about the money.
No, absolutely. And that makes such a big difference to your self-esteem and how you feel about yourself.
Yep, exactly. Well, this is clearly a really good profile that we've done today. Thanks for bringing this to us, because I mean, they're charity that prevents and helps treat blindness and works to build a more inclusive world for disabled people. So what's not to like? And Fern, something else on the radar that we may want to say a few words about and bring attention. Available, if we can talk about it, is a certain podcast, which this month is kind of following this theme and looking at an aspect of disability. So, you want to tell us a little bit about Into You?
Yeah. Do you know what? I thought that you might never mention that, Ramya, and I'm so glad you did, because, you know, it's a pressing issue, as we all know. Yes, the latest episode of Into You, the podcast hosted by myself, if you didn't already know, where have you been? It is now out on your favorite podcatcher. I know you've all got one. Everyone's got a favorite podcatcher. And this month is dealing with dating and disability. So if you're disabled and you've had some dating experiences, you might be able to relate to some of the experiences shared. My two disabled guests have amazing attitudes to life, and they've got some really interesting views on dating. So you don't want to miss it.
Sounds awesome. Yeah. And I like how you make mention everybody has their favorite podcatcher, because that you want to talk about something being personal is when you talk to people and, oh, I prefer this podcatcher. I find it easy to use. Oh, it's ridiculous. I don't like that one. I like everyone's got their thing, Fern, as you said.
Absolutely. You know it. Yeah. And I don't mind which one you listen to, but just make sure you listen. Okay.
Oh, that's it. How is production going? I mean, I know your partner, you guys put it together and everything like that, and things sound good and you have fun with it. But now that you're this far in, what has been the biggest challenge doing a podcast?
Working with my other half. I mean, I think the ironic thing is I'm doing a dating and relationship podcast. And yes, as you say, my technician sound guy is my partner. So that's always good fun. I mean, as I've mentioned on the show before, we never have a crossword between us. It is, you know, a paradise relationship. Of sorts. But, you know, sometimes you just have to battle through some challenges, some ups and downs, but it's all right. We're okay. We're still together.
No fights in paradise. I've never heard of that.
Artistic creativity?
Yeah. Yeah, whatever you want to spin it. You know, he talked about verbiage earlier on the show, too. This is a good example of it.
That's the polite way of putting it.
And Fern, you've mentioned before as well, and I just want to bring it up because you mentioned talking disability on the upcoming episode, that it wasn't going to be a super disability-focused podcast. It comes and goes, and especially for you who has the experience of disability, but not all your guests and not all your topics revolve around the intersectionality with disability.
No, exactly. And I think, again, that's another part of normalizing it. Like I was just saying in that story, that some issues, yes, are very disability orientated. And there's some things that, you know, as disabled people, we go through that non-disabled people won't go through. But the majority of things, especially when you're talking about emotional issues, like we were saying with getting a job and relationships and dating, a lot of the things that you go through are the same things, whether you have a disability or not. So, you know, I did a podcast on ghosting. Anyone can go through that. And this time we just wanted to focus on disability from both sides, to see it, you know, from a non-disabled point of view and a disabled point of view, and just explore that a little bit. And obviously, you know, like you say, I've got a vested interest. I've been there. I know what it's like to date with a disability. So yeah, it's just great to explore all of those issues and to talk to some really interesting guests. So one of them had cerebral palsy and is a wheelchair user, and the other one was born with only one arm. And then you got me, who's blind, in the mix. So we got a whole spectrum of different things going on.
Different experiences to share. It's really a lot about one's perspective. Everyone, we all go through each thing in our life, but when we go through it, it's our own. Oh my, you know, nobody in the world has gone through this.
Yeah, absolutely. You can feel very alone at times in dating, can't you? But actually, it's true. When every time I do these podcasts and I talk to guests, they always say something that I can relate to, whoever they are. You know, they could be completely different from me, but something they say will really strike a hard emotional chord with me. And it's amazing. And like I say, it just goes to show how similar we all are, regardless of our surface level differences.
Correct. No matter what the topic is. Fernie, as usual, great. Good luck with the podcast. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Thanks. Can't wait. Have a good show.
Thank you. Fern Lullum joins us every other Thursday for UK Disability Highlights here on Kelly and Company. Coming up next, Helton Healthcare is piloting Blind Square to create a more accessible experience by ensuring that individuals with sight loss have the opportunity to navigate the hospital safely and very independently. We speak with Jack McCormick next, organizational development consultant of Helton Healthcare, about how this project is going. Stand by. AMI Audio, it's available from your television. Cogeco Ontario, ladies and gentlemen. Subscribers over there, you guys can find us on channel 596 and TELUS channel 889 in Western Canada. Visit ami.ca/schedules for a list of channel locations in your area. I'm Kelly MacDonald. Welcome to your Thursday. My co-host, Ramya Muthan.
Well, we're going to be talking about a pretty cool project that we're going to be learning more about right now. It's Halton Healthcare, and they're piloting Blind Square. It's a project including Blind Square to create a more accessible experience by ensuring that individuals with sight loss have the opportunity to navigate the hospital safely and independently. And we're going to talk to someone who's returning back to the show, I think for the second time, maybe more than that. But one of my friends, Jack McCormick, he's the organizational development consultant of Halton Healthcare, and he's here to tell us more about the project. Jack, thanks for coming on and giving this or bringing this to our attention.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rami and Kelly.
So some of us have heard about Blind Square before, Jack, and we're curious to see how far it's gone in helping the community when it comes to navigation, travel, orientation, etc. So for some of us who may not be familiar with it, can you give us some details about Blind Square?
Yeah, so Blind Square is a really cool app designed for both indoor and outdoor navigation for people who are blind or partially sighted. Outside, it uses GPS signals to tell your points of interest near you, what streets you're on, and where you are. Indoors, it uses Bluetooth beacons because GPS signals aren't good enough indoors. So
Right. These
are like physical items about the size of, smaller than a hockey puck that gets stuck on a wall. And they send a message to your phone as you walk by. And then that message is then read with a voice similar to like a screen reader that tells you, if you're walking by the elevator bay, that you're at the elevator, or if you're near the food court, that you're near the food court, and what restaurants are closest to you.
We've seen people, Jack, talk about this, or I've heard people chat about it, for sports arenas, let's say, for an example, or a stadium, or an even massive project would be subway stations because of the underground. And when I knew we were talking about this, I'm like, wow, like a healthcare facility. So how do you use the technology in that kind of application? Because you could be talking about different buildings. Again, you're still talking size, and certainly this would be the best application.
Yeah, so it's really interesting you say that. So our hospital is 1.6 million square feet, which is just massive.
Yeah.
And the way that CNIB helped us design the implementation of this Bluetooth beacon project is that the Bluetooth beacons direct you in sort of the public-facing areas of the hospital and help you find all those key areas. So the reception counters where you check in for different clinic areas at each floor. And so these beacons are going to tell you how to get to those spaces and which of those spaces are near you, so that it would take hundreds and hundreds of beacons to do every small back hallway
right.
in the hospital, and it just wouldn't be practical because it'd have information overload. So with an organization, a building that's as big as 1.6 million square feet, we only needed to install, I think, 34 beacons.
Okay. So can you talk more about that? What went into installing or making this pilot project happen to begin with?
Yeah. So at Halton Healthcare, I was really fortunate the organization was so willing to support this project. A colleague of mine who's responsible for diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives at the organization reached out to me and said, Jack, do you have any other ideas to make the hospital more accessible? And myself, I have a vision impairment, and I had used Blind Square at one of the subway stations in Toronto and was really impressed. And I was like, I've heard of this Blind Square technology. I use the app when I'm navigating outdoors. Maybe this is something we could look into. And so her and I, at Halton Healthcare, there's what's called an innovation grant that any staff member who has an innovative or new idea that they'd like to bring to the organization can apply for money to get these ideas off the ground. So we applied for an innovation grant, and we're successful, and so the organization paid to install all the beacons. So it was really cool to be able to, bring this idea to our senior leadership team and have it be endorsed by them.
How did the conversations go, Jack, about where the deciding factor? Because obviously, when you say to them, well, you can't put them all over the hospital, these are great. Oh, we can be, but all over the hospital wouldn't be a good idea. Well, why not? Too expensive. Oh, so you have to make the choice of where they're going to go. And as a user, where we're going to get the most benefit, those must have been some interesting conversations, or, you know, when you had to stop and think about it and hope they trust in the decision made and that it shows and pays itself back.
Yeah, I think the CNIB did a really good job of helping us position that and help identify what those key points are. So the first level of our hospital, where the most people, you know, everyone enters through the first level, obviously, has the most beacons because it's where you've got the most opportunity to get lost,
right?
All that kind of thing. And then what these beacons are doing is directing you to the key points of interest on the first level, like the elevator bays. And so the advantage to the way the hospital is designed is if someone takes, you know, an elevator from the first floor to the third floor, in the center tower, there's pretty much only one to two spots that they can go to. It's either going to be to, you know, reception counter A or reception counter B. So the beacon on the third floor only has to direct the person to that point, at which point a staff member can direct them where to wait, or, you know, where their family member who's staying in the hospital is located, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so there's a bit of that combination, right, of you being able to navigate through the hospital, but we know how hospitals can be in general from a lot of experience, where you do need the assistance because of very specific things that you might want to interact with somebody for. And have you gotten any feedback, Jack, on how the pilot's going so far with visitors or even with yourself?
Yeah, so we just launched, I want to say, about a week and a half ago.
Nice.
I haven't got any specific user feedback. I know, as someone who has vision loss myself, I was fortunate enough to help test the project and make sure that, you know, all the messages were working and making sense after, the folks from the CNIB installed it. So, you know, I'm very pleased to say it gives excellent instructions and, is very helpful, to help identify those places. We're hoping to get some more people in post-COVID to test it and get some more feedback in that regard. But, you know, the pandemic's definitely making that kind of thing a little challenging right now.
How do you, with the help of maybe, you know, Blind Square, the players involved, get the word out? Because this would be wonderful if others approach you, say, hey, you know, we are a hockey arena in Belleville. How do we employ this? And how many of these things do we have to have? How can we do this inexpensively, but certainly not inconvenience our customer?
Mm-hmm. I guess the best, what I can suggest is contacting the CNIB, and they can definitely help anyone listening to this, get this installed in their own organization. They're incredible to work with. The person who sort of guided the project for us, his name is Gregor Barnes. So he's definitely available to help and implement projects like this anywhere in Canada for people who are listening. And I know I was speaking to some individuals, and it sounds like other organizations have heard that we've done this and are already getting interested in trying to do this in their organizations too. So, you know, by more people doing it, the word spreads quickly, it seems.
Yeah. And that's what we like to hear. I mean, specifically, you know, hospitals, but anything really, when we talked about airports having this kind of technology, or
malls.
It doesn't even, yeah, malls, exactly. Somewhere where you know that it's not a uniform style approach, which is what makes it that much more important that these technologies are available. I remember when IRA, being another way for people who are blind or low vision to help navigated, was starting to become available in more places as a free service. And I was like, this is great. Let it expand into bigger and more crazier environments. So, Jack, one thing I touched on was that kind of thing where, you know, the approach is not uniform. Were there questions and answers and different kind of things being considered when putting Blind Square into these beacons into the hospital, where to kind of mishmash it so that, yes, you, there's a beacon here, but you know that people will need that assistance from a staff member, for example.
Yeah, there was definitely like some interesting conversations about, like, you know, in you know, some of these very complex areas where there's lots of different halls, what's the best way to describe this space to someone who can't see it so that they get the right message at the right time? One thing I found really cool actually about the beacons is you can actually adjust the strength of the message they send. So whether the message gets sent, you know, 5 feet or 20 feet or, you know, there's like three or four different levels that you can adjust the power of the beacon to help adjust when that person's going to receive the message. So even playing around with like things of that level of detail helps create an even better experience for people.
Excellent. Well, that's amazing, Guy. And I'm really thankful that other people are picking up on this and saying that they also want to be jumping in and putting Blind Square pilots and projects into their own organizations. Is there anywhere you want to point us to for more information on the Halton Healthcare pilot project with Blind Square?
Yeah, if individuals go to the Halton Healthcare website, all the information about Blind Square and how to use it at our hospital can be found on the accessibility page of our website. And there's lots of fantastic information there.
Okay, perfect. And we have that on our blog as well, ami.ca/Kellyco. Jack, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
We were speaking with Jack McCormick, Organizational Development Consultant of Halton Healthcare, talking to us about their pilot project using Blind Square.
Top of the next hour, we flip through quirky stories with Jeff Ryman and What in the World. We have the roundtable with Jenny Bovard joining us. And up next, Nick D'Ambrosio kicks it all off with his community report. So much to do each day, but when you can take some time to be with us, we appreciate it, folks. If by chance, you know, the live show isn't something you can make, you got something planned, check out the Kelly and Company podcast. You can listen to the show in segment form or the complete Kelly and Company podcast experience. We throw on an audio vanity card at the end, and you've got the whole show, beginning, middle, end, all the parts, all the fun. That's the Kelly and Company podcast. Please subscribe using your favorite podcatcher. Kelly McDonald, host of the show, my co-host in her home studio in Toronto, Ramya Muthan. And on Tuesdays and Thursdays, we get an opportunity to bring on the program one of our community reporters. We do this so that we can find out what's going on in their neck of the woods. Always so many different things that these guys bring to us and report in on. And who never disappoints, from Montreal, Nick D'Ambrosio. Nikolai, welcome back.
Yeah. How's everything going, Kelly?
So far, fantastic, sir. We've had a great show and lots ahead. And I'm looking at the list of topics here. So if you don't mind, I want to kick this thing right off and we'll get a COVID report, since right now in Canada, that's our number one concern.
Yeah, you know, it's been kind of interesting to look at the different provinces and to find out how things are going in each province. And, you know, yes. I find it, you know, important that I kind of keep things up to date here. But it's been kind of trying times to keep up to date with COVID reports in Quebec, and even specifically even in my own city of Montreal. But just to give you a couple of things, there are a couple of code reds districts in Quebec. The Lévis, Quebec City, and Gatineau are now in the red zones. And so basically what that means is gyms and hairdressers and restaurants are closed. Of course, you can still get takeout and stuff. And here in Montreal, it's been pretty much status quo, but things have yet stayed the same, but changed as well. So our curfew is still at 9:30. You know, and in my last report, I said that the gyms are open. Well, they're closed again.
Yeah.
I also told you that the schools were open and that kids were back at school, and now they're not. basically they're going back to a hybrid of half virtual, half in class. So as you can see, we're kind of going through the emotions with Mr. Legault and the yo-yo effect that's been happening. But I want to talk about some positive stuff. The positive stuff is that the shots are going very, very well. The vaccinations are going very well. I know family, I know friends that have done it. And they said it's been a wonderful experience, and it's been fast, it's been efficient, they've been courteous. So that's great. If anybody's interested to get shots, you go to the ClickSante website. That's clicksante.ca. And also your local pharmacies. And a little birdie, Mr. Legault, kind of told us that the next number is 55 and over, and as well as cancer people and essential workers might be next in line. So I might be next in line to get the shot. So I'm looking forward to that. So, you know, go to the website, go to your local pharmacies, make some phone calls if you fall in the category and get your shot. And we're getting there. It's getting better. I'm hopeful.
Well, we see the light. And, you know, Nick, I find though there seems to be, when we talk of the variants and things that are going on, more anxiety, more fear right now, because you feel like, oh, my goodness, we're close to emerging and then a little twist. So the race is on and you just want to do the right thing. So you're part of the race as you see these scary numbers every day. You know, and that's all you can do is hang in and hope. And it does so far. Everybody I've talked to, it's been a good experience. Yeah. Study on echolocation.
Yeah, this is a survey done by the University of Montreal. And before I begin, there is a criteria to do this survey. You need to be 18 years of age. You need to be blind, low vision, or deafblind. And you need to have, you know, traveled a little bit throughout this pandemic. Now, what this survey is for is basically to help people understand the echolocation, wearing masks, the difficulties you have, also the orientation and mobility difficulties we face going outside. And I thought this was great, a great survey, because we need information about what are the barriers and what we can do to help ourselves. Is this the new norm? I'm not sure. But nonetheless, the barriers are still there and they're going to be there for a while. And so having this survey done will help us find solutions to maybe help us later on. The leading researcher in this is Dr. Walter Wittich from the University of Montreal. And so basically the form is in English and French. It's totally accessible. They need about 150 participants. I've already done it. And I think it was helpful to go through the motions and go through the questions and really think about things as you're doing it. If you have any questions, you can contact them. And the phone number is 514-343-7962 if you have any problems about the accessibility of it. But it went really well for me. Now, you know, on to the problems that we face as a blind community. You know, we went through this. It's been a year, you know, social distancing, the lineups and stuff. But also wearing a mask is sometimes echolocation is important, where, you know, we don't hear very well where someone is talking to us because of the masks. And so there's just a lot of different aspects that I didn't really think about when I was doing the survey. And then I was like, yeah, it's true. I didn't realize that. So it's really great. I urge people to do the survey. It's in the show notes, the link. It's a little bit long, convoluted website. So I urge everybody to go and check out the thing and do the survey. And lastly, you can win an Amazon gift card of $100 if you participate. It is anonymous. But if you want to leave your email address to try to win the Amazon card, you can. So I urge everybody to go out there and do it. It's only going to take 5-10 minutes anyway. Don't worry about it. It's not too long.
AMI.ca/KellyCo for our blog where that link is. You know, we've talked about this on the program, Nick, and from being a former goalball player where I had to wear a blindfold, and we used to ask, well, why do we have to wear a blindfold, especially the ones who are total? What's mm-hmm. the difference? And a lot of that came down to, yeah, but off of your face surface, you can also feel, you can sense. And the mass I've felt, you know, I noticed that deprivation, having it around my cheeks, my face, the lower part, that I do feel thrown off a bit, that something's not quite right. It must be in my focus on breathing or whatever. A lot of it is that skin texture, not being able to sense the air, sense around.
Yeah, also, Kelly, having the preoccupation of moving the mask when it slips and stuff, you're distracted. You're distracted.
And any movement makes you adjust your head and stuff like that, which could carry you out of the direction you're going, not just be that distraction, but literally pull you over, like something resting on your shoulder is going to make you move away from it or to that direction. Yeah. This is interesting, sir, especially as sports fans. Locker room and clubhouse.
Yeah, you know, the clubhouse, I call it the clubhouse craze. Everybody's on Clubhouse. It's a great app. And, you know, there's great groups like the 15% with people with all kinds of disabilities that get together. We got old friends and new friends. But there was one thing lacking, Kelly. There wasn't enough sports in the app. And so I was told about, a friend of mine told me about Locker Room. And I was like, okay, let me try it out. It's an audio-based group of people, like-minded people who love sports. And the beauty of this is that it's exactly like Clubhouse, but there's one little caveat, Kelly. The accessibility is not as strong as Clubhouse. But if you are familiar with Clubhouse, you'll get very familiar with Locker Room because it's exactly the same thing. You can follow people. People can follow you. You can join groups. You can raise your hands to speak. So all the buttons are there. I would say about 70% of the buttons are there. There's still some that are kind of like, you know, accessibility problems. And the more blind people use it, the better it is. And what a better time to get into the locker room craze than now. All sports are going on, except for the NFL. But we know the NFL never shuts down. The draft is coming up. So baseball is up, basketball is up, hockey's up. And this is a great opportunity to, you know, get involved in that type of audio chat format with sports. Now, when I first logged into it, I had to wait a little bit of time to get in. You don't need an invite like Clubhouse. You can just download it and get in.
Good.
And that's the cool thing. And then you just add your teams that you like, and then you take it from there. And then when groups pop up, you just join in and talk about, you know, whatever it is, the latest trade, the latest game, or whatever it is. So really great. I enjoy it a lot. It's a great alternative to Clubhouse to get away from sometimes the minutiae that's going around. Just for me, I love my sports, and that's my distraction. So
Do you have game watching rooms? Have you sat in a room while you guys are watching a Canadiens game or something?
No, not yet. But I have been following the NFL draft and, you know, following different combines and things like that. So it's really good. It's just a lot of great little things. There's not enough hours in the day, Kelly.
No. You couldn't. If you're a huge fan of all sports, you must be done on an app like that. It's one thing if you sit for baseball and you just, oh, I love it. And even that, you know, I'm sure you could immerse yourself. That's awesome. Thanks for bringing that forward. I had not heard of that. And that is really a cool thing. Sir, let's get a little more sports conversation into the show here. The Sport for Me program. Let's talk about young kids getting to learn all about sports.
Yeah, so this is done by the SAC, and so this is great because it's getting involved kids from ages 6 to 12, and it's going to be a program from April to June every Saturday. It's going to get kids to get up their social skills as well as their orientation skills by playing different sports. They're going to be hooked up with a coach. And so basically there's all kinds of sports like goalball, like you just mentioned, Kelly, as well as wall climbing. I know we've done a little bit of wall climbing.
Oh, yeah. People love it now. It is so loved.
But they'll be doing the fun part. You know?
Yeah.
And so this is going to be great for them to get involved and to learn these sports and to get outside. And I know that, you know, they said it's going to be going on, and I'm crossing my finger for all these little kids out there that want to get out because the weather is beautiful here in Montreal. And so this is the time for them to learn about goalball and climbing and, you know, orientation and activities and also getting out there with the other kids and socializing a bit with social distancing and all of that good stuff. So if anybody wants any information, you can call Annie Gervais-Massé. And the phone number to contact her is 514-252-3178, extension 3775, for any additional information to get your little tyke out there and playing some sports in the springtime. The weather's nice. I don't need to mention that. The winter's finally over, Kelly. We did it.
It's beautiful. And getting people interested early in sports, always a positive. And at least it gives people choice while they still are having fun with it before all that competitiveness gets in. And in the meanwhile, Nick, for us older guys, let's grab our vitamin water and we'll get into the locker room. Start watching our own.
Go and sit on our butts.
That's right.
And watch the NFL draft or something. Yeah.
That's right. We're in the best way. And, you know, our American friends out there, they'll sit there and certainly be all saluting their NFL content to talk about. Thanks,
yeah,
pal.
No doubt. You got it. We'll talk soon.
We will put all this up on the blog, ami.ca/KellyCo. That's Nick D'Ambrosio. He is our community reporter in Montreal, Quebec, talking to us about different things going on in Quebec. So please check all that stuff out on the blog. If any of these things interest you and you just couldn't keep track of it, do it there. We'll take a break. And coming up next, What in the World with Jeff Ryman. Welcome back to the program. Rumya Muth and Kelly McDonald. We're the hosts of the show. Thanks for being with us and appreciate your time, ladies and gentlemen. Remember, check us out via TuneIn Radio, OOTunes. They're great apps. You can download them on your phone and take us with you. We'd appreciate it. If you are a person that uses one of the Victor Reader streams, by the way, and you listen to some of our podcasts that way, via that HumanWare Victor Reader equipment, take a listen, please, here. If that's the case, due to a recent upgrade, AMI Audio Podcast may no longer update on your device. So to solve this issue, please unsubscribe and resubscribe to your favorite AMI Audio Podcast, and then restart your device. Thanks a lot. Appreciate you listening in to AMI Podcast. Keep enjoying. It's time, ladies and gentlemen, to welcome Jeff Ryman, our other producer on the program, for one of people's favorite segments, What in the World?
The defendant's guilty verdict in a firearms case can't be automatically reversed just because the judge dozed off. The cries were that of a 40-year-old parrot named what? Rambo. Let me out. Some of it weird, some of it just crazy. This is What in the World on Kelly and Company.
Mind-boggling.
Regarding that comment I made about being one of the favorite segments, really that's just reflected by the voices heard on that doorbell there opening up and bringing Jeffy on. Sir, what we do on the second and fourth Thursday of the month, we flip through some quirky items that you get from around the world. We've entitled this What in the World. Welcome back, sir.
It's good to be back, although I'm a little bit I'm not very happy because you guys are making fun of my squeaky chair, my squeaky desk chair.
Now, it sounds like a bird.
What the audience has to understand is it's so much fun on the breaks to plant certain things in the heads of, like, Rumya, Nelly, hot in here today because it's warm over there. Jeff, oh, that's a chair. What did it remind us of? So you know it's going to come back. It's like that. Oh, really? Make fun of my chair.
That should be part of your pig impression, by the way.
That's really?
Piggish.
Pig impression is more like not. That's more like a bad goose. So Jeffrey, you were saying?
Yeah, this chair. I'm not very happy. You guys made fun of it. I don't know why it's squeaky.
Well,
by the way,
give us a sample.
Well, okay, I'll try.
It barely does it there. It's doing it, but it
sounds
it's like
a rocking chair.
Yeah, there it did. Well, there it sounded like a nice, easy chair that someone said, oh, yes. Grandpa. But yeah, no.
You'll probably hear it at some point when I'm on air. And the crazy thing is like you probably think this is some ancient chair, but it's not. I got it maybe 3 months ago.
Oh, wow.
So
yeah,
I think, you know,
still have the ink drying. I just like when Matt said, hey, when are you going to oil that? Well, I'm not.
Yeah, it adds character. It's great.
Oh, my goodness.
It gives us something good to talk about. And speaking of something good, good to talk about, maybe not. Maybe not for me. I'm not a fan because, and Kelly, you might like this. Rumya, you probably aren't going to like this segment because there's actually a couple of sports articles.
Uh-oh. Be careful. She'll plug
it
her
it is kind of, these are fun sports articles. Mm-hmm. Although this one has to do with Tom Brady, who I despise. Yeah, I'm not a huge fan. I mean, he murdered my Buffalo Bills on a yearly basis, on a game basis. So yeah, I've despised Tom Brady for quite some time.
Yeah,
now.
You almost had Rumya's interest there when you said murder. She's, oh, hold on a second.
Wait a sport, minute.
An athlete killer,
yes.
Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. But he is a great quarterback, the greatest quarterback of all time.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know, I do have to give credit where credit is due. And when it comes to playing at the NFL level, like I said, Tom Brady is the GOAT, greatest of all time.
Not the lamb, the GOAT.
But there's no question he's the greatest of all time when it comes to collectibles on the market. A rookie football card of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers quarterback signed by Tom Brady himself. Any ideas how much this thing sold for, guys?
Well, what blows my mind is it's Tampa Bay. It's not even the team he played.
I know.
Like it. It's the team he switched for. Sorry, I would say that probably about, oh... I think now it's so new, probably 8,000.
Okay. From you?
It's low.
Is it? Is it
go a higher?
Is it higher?
Try something
right?
Foolish.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Try something foolish.
It's like 50 grand?
Yeah, I'd try that.
You guys aren't even in the same ballpark. I think I'm just going to leave you guys now.
Tell us.
We've insulted the GOAT.
Kelsey, it actually was a rookie card, but Tom Brady obviously doesn't play for New England, who he was drafted by, but. It was a rookie card. It sold for $2.25 million.
Oh, my
wow.
God.
The price was achieved last Friday through an online sports auction, and that broke the previous mark also held by Tom Brady. Another one of his rookie cards sold for $1.32 million just last month. So, of course, grading systems when it comes into these cards probably was a huge factor. I'm guessing that one that just sold for $2.25 million that was signed by Brady is in near mint condition.
Yeah, probably bend in the corner. Nothing like that. And it could also be an earlier print of it.
Yeah, it very well could be. It could be a different print. But for $2.25 million, and you know how big a card is, it's probably in some sort of container or concealment. I'm assuming it's probably no bigger than the size of a cell phone. Wow. And for $2.25 million to go into the man cave, I think that's a rather large number for my liking. And like I said, not a huge Tom Brady guy, but $2.25 million. Some collector out there forked over a lot of money. And
what's scary
is
when you look at something like that, and then versus when I think we recently on here at some point, Jeff, I recall us talking about Gretzky's rookie card and that value on that. And you stop and think, well, it's just the NFL. It's Tom Brady. It's a whole different ball game of interest and fan loyalty and people out there that would be willing to pay that over, like they say, something is only worth what someone's willing to pay.
I mean, football and basketball are probably the big ones, especially here in North America. Hockey cards are huge in Canada. I'm not exactly sure what the market is like, especially down south of the border in the United States. So you're right. I think it depends on the sport. It depends on the athlete. It depends on the condition. You know, there's lots of different factors that come into play here, but that one that was just signed, like I said, by Tom Brady and sold for $2.25 million must be pretty much perfect. And Tom Brady was drafted over 20 years ago. So somebody just had that card, has had that rookie card for quite some time as well. So
yeah,
interesting to see.
And that blew your mind away considering baseball cards or hockey cards that go back to like the 30s and 40s that are floating around.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I'm sure, you know, lots of Babe Ruth cards, Mickey Mantle, those types of guys who are legends from back in the day, especially with the New York Yankees. Those guys, their cards go for a pretty penny. I want to switch gears and sticking with sports as well. This one comes from mixed martial arts. And a fighter ended up being handed a victory after his opponent had his finger torn off during a match.
Oh,
I saw this come across my Twitter feed, I think about a week ago. And it was kind of funny, but also kind of worrisome. And I had to do a double check because the tweet was like, okay, we're in this facility and a fighter is missing a finger and we don't know where it is. and we need a back because we want to sew it back on. And that came over the PA system. And I'm thinking, wait, what? What did I just read? Somebody lost their finger. They've misplaced it, and now they want to get it re-sewn. It was ridiculous. I've never seen anything like it. But
could you imagine being the person that stepped on it and found it? You know, especially if they stepped on it from the ring, you hear, ow!
It's crazy. So what happened last Thursday, actually, when one fighter, his last name is Plev, was injured during the second round of his fight with Devin Goodale. The referee stopped the round after noticing Plev was missing his left right finger. Plev says Goodale caught his glove with one hand and he felt his finger snap. Ugh. He says he wanted to keep fighting, but the referee obviously said, no, dude, you're missing your finger. You can't really keep competing here. It took several minutes of searching to find that finger. Like I mentioned, no one really knew where it was, but it actually was still just inside the glove.
Are you taking a lesson from Shackleton? It's like I'm listening to Bill telling a story. Well, I know. Glove.
Too descriptive for our own good.
Oh, did you scream out, Rum? I'm glad I have mute. As soon as he said it was tore off, I was like, over here.
Definitely clenching my teeth through this whole thing. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. It was kind of funny afterwards. So he ended up getting it repaired. He got it reattached, but there still may need to be one more surgery or several surgeries. I mean, when you lose a finger, you might need a couple more surgeries after that. But there was a picture of him smiling in the doctor's office after he got his finger reattached. So he found it kind of funny. And like I said, he wanted to keep fighting, which was ridiculous. Like, dude, you just lost your finger.
Well, put it on ice when you find it.
I know, exactly. Ridiculous. So I thought that was kind of funny. I mean, those people who are squirmish
out there. You'd get pretty mad at the guy that tore your finger off, Jeff. I think you'd probably want to keep fighting him too. Well, you find it, put it on ice, I take care of this clown.
I know.
The adrenaline too, right, guys? Like, on a real note.
Oh, yeah, and the shock.
We know of athletes who just get it through and then realize later how bad the injury is, or in this case, how badly your finger came off because the adrenaline just pushes you through so much of that stuff. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I mean, MMA fighters just live by that motto. It's like they're running off of adrenaline. They're getting punched in the head. They're getting punched all over their bodies. You know, it looks like it hurts on TV. It does. Don't get me wrong.
Does.
But in that moment, they're not even thinking about that. The pain is about a day later. You know, the next day after you wake up.
And the conditioning helps too, just like we see in sports of any kind.
But, just hearing this story, and it popped up on my Twitter feed last week and I shared it with my friends. You know, it was
a little
bit funny, and it was something that I thought I had to pass along. But like I said, there are probably some people who are screaming at their streams right now saying, why did you have to tell us that?
Oh, especially people out east trying to have dinner.
I know.
Sorry, people. Jeffy, it's all fun and games till someone loses a finger.
I know. I have one more we can squeeze in here. Again, kind of sports related about yoga, but people in Alabama trying to get yoga programs reinstated at public schools can't relax just yet. Conservative groups are flexing against efforts to ease the ban, which has been in place for decades. Yoga is banned in Alabama schools. I don't know why. People just apparently don't like doing yoga down in Alabama. And due to their objections, a state panel has held off on advancing the measure. Some anti-yoga forces worry that having yoga in schools might lead to promoting Hinduism or guided meditation practices. The main backer of the bill says it's aimed at getting kids exercise, not religion. Kind of a ridiculous thing. Yoga is great. I do it all the time. Just get it going down there, Alabama. What are you doing?
This person making their statement from way, way, way back in the woods. Anyway, take it easy, sir. Thank you, Jeff. You've joined us for a couple of Thursdays a month, and we have What in the World. We'll be right back with the Kelly and Company Roundtable.
Isn't it convenient that we have a round table?
Well, it's actually oval. Just say it.
The blind guy feels it now, goes, well, I guess it is oval.
Kind of oval.
Well, we do this every Thursday on the program. Rumi and I gather with a guest or two, or like last week, three, as a matter of fact. This is an open conversation on a variety of subjects. Picked out by myself. Nobody knows what we're going to talk about. One of the things we've been trying to do on the program is welcome people to our podcast collection that's out there. You always hear us promote our show, Voice of the Walrus, The Pulse, Now with Dave Brown. And we have some other ones that we really love people to know about. The Halifax School for the Blind. And we really, just to name one of the bunch that are out there. One of the others that we want to talk a little bit about is hosted by Jenny Bovart. And she is host of the Low Vision Moments podcast. We welcome her to the program from Halifax. How are you?
I'm doing so well. I'm so happy to have wheeled my desk chair from my work computer, my day job, over to the microphone. Very excited.
A long distance. Nice. That's the way it's been for all of us. You know, what a distance. I moved rooms. I've got to relax now. Jenny, tell us about the podcast first.
Well, low vision moments themselves are those things that happen in everyday life when you're just trying to go about your day, either with low vision or if you're someone who identifies as blind. And, you know, you can be doing everything right, using all the tools, technologies, rehab you've been handed and acquired over the years. And those low vision moments still happen. They can be frustrating. They can be potentially embarrassing, but there's often some funny in there. There's some comedy in there too. And that's what I try to highlight in the podcast. So it's number one, comedy. Number two, some good story time, some good conversation, and hopefully stuff that people can relate to. But the other thing I try to do is engage listeners that may not have a personal connection to vision loss or low vision or blindness, and kind of bring them into our world and demystify some of the stuff they might see us doing out there in public, whether we're ignoring them or cutting in line or whatever.
Mm. That's where I want to start, ladies. Be really great, Jenny. There's two things that I want to get our roundtable off to discussion with. And that is exactly what you said about the perception people must have when they see us, when they deal with a person with a disability, and do we laugh? You know, how much do we laugh at ourselves and the things that happen within reason? What the sensitivity levels that people have in respect to us in their feeling, and sometimes for us, while we're chuckling away at, going to turn a corner and saying, oh, hi there. Oh, shoot, that's a mirror. And those things that happen constantly. I'm going to start with you, Jenny, for those sharing stories that we'll also talk about that in a moment. But when you, with doing the show, I think you're about 7 episodes in. Am I right there?
You're right. Coming up on 7. Yep.
Okay. So with the conversations you have, the life experience you have, and everything that's gone on, the people you've spoke to, and including with your day job, I would think that that's one of the things that we struggle with in making people realize, yeah, we do laugh at a lot of things. Yeah, we have these unfortunate things happen. I mean, the reaction of when you bang your leg and someone's sees you do it, but because we bump our legs or move around that way, it's not a shock to us. And sometimes we have to educate ourselves that, yeah, but they don't realize that.
Well, I think you're right. For a lot of us, you know, those things that happen that might appear, you know, that people might worry about us or think maybe we're a little more inebriated than we really are. You know, when people are making these assumptions or having these perceptions out there in public or social situations or what have you, for most of us, that's normal. We've had lots of time to adjust and deal with. Yes, it might be heavy or frustrating at times, but the majority of the time we have to learn to laugh at ourselves. Otherwise, you're just going to be ticked off all the time because it's work, right? Like just to go do your groceries, especially right now, like there's so much more planning involved if you don't drive or if you have to have, you know, you have to make all these considerations. So I think that's the case for a lot of us, but not necessarily everybody. For people who might be newer to vision loss, or like I'm someone who was born with the same eyesight that I have now in my 30s, and it's taken me forever to come around to having this more positive attitude about it. So I think for some people, including some of my guests, It's refreshing for them to see the comedic side and be more open about it. I hear from a lot of my guests, they're like, you know, that was so refreshing and cathartic because there's, number one, not that many people I can talk to about this. But number two, it's, you know, it's not, people are sensitive and they want to be sensitive to our feelings and our needs. And so they don't know when it's okay to laugh. So I think it's, that's part of the podcast is like telling people here, you know, here are the context when it's okay to laugh. You know, if we're laughing, please laugh with us. Don't tell me you're going to pray for me if I'm having a good laugh at myself. That's going to change the mood.
Because you may not, after I start laughing at you praying for me, you might not want to pray for me because I'm okay. You know, and there certainly prayers can be used in better places than worrying about how I'm adjusting. And we are fortunate when we have made, as you said, Jenny, it's taken you to get into your 30s to make that adjustment. Rumya, you and I have talked on the show and laughed a lot about the things we do. I know myself, I've always felt carrying my white cane speaks for me. It helps a lot because I'm a big guy, and if I'm coming towards people and I don't know they're there, am I taking up too much sidewalk? Am I, you know, and the first thing people think, well, you obnoxious person, move over. Or like Jenny said, is this guy drunk? He just ran me right over and now is trying to help me up. For you, Rum, moving around, doing things, these moments that we're talking about of wanting to be a little more comfortable, have they come to you? Because we've talked often that it took you a while to say, yeah, I'll use a cane.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that I started laughing more around my teenagers, because before that, I felt that I was just not taking it in, right? Taking it in the point of view of like, oh, what are other people seeing when I do this or when I travel this way or when I bump into things? But when I was a teenager, a few of us would hang out together. We were like the blind, low vision crew. And we all have different
levels
of vision. Yes, and degrees of sight. So we would sometimes see, like I would see one of my friends doing something silly and laugh out loud, or they vice versa. So we got to kind of see the perspective of, oh, is this what other people are seeing when we do this stuff, but not around other blind people who are pointing it out? So that's when I started to realize that there are levels and layers to how some of this stuff can be super, super funny. You know, sometimes I assume that other people didn't see it. Like if I didn't, you know, if I walked away
people laugh at themselves for doing the things they do, whether someone catches them or not. Look at me.
Of course. But there's this narrow perspective. Mm-hmm. Like I used to walk through malls and bump into mannequins, like things that literally look like people to me, and either bump into them or walk around them or apologize or even ask some of them questions. Like, excuse me, where can I find that? Oh, that's a mannequin. And then, and then think that because I walked away so casually and coolly that nobody else saw that. Oh my God. And then my friend, one of my sighted friends who's really good friends with me from high school onwards, she started coining it as blind people problems. And she was like, oh, you just had a blind people problem right there. Or, you know, if I wasn't here, nobody would have noticed that blind person problem. So it was a good way to start laughing at something like this. And Jenny, that's why I appreciate your podcast so much, because sometimes we think, haha, but not really. Or, you know, we get into the embarrassed side of things, but we really had to let it out, you know, and just,
sometimes we think the world's laughing at us, and it's us.
At us, exactly. You
know? It's okay for us to joke with our blind friends, laugh at what we do, but if someone, a sighted person, boy, you look funny doing that. What'd you say?
That's right.
You're comfortable.
Yeah.
But Jenny, sometimes it's not always funny in the moment.
No.
It's not. It's not.
Embarrassed. And then it takes days, weeks, months, whatever, to come back to it. And you're like, okay.
Later on.
Actually, that time I, you know, went into that really deep puddle on my cul-de-sac, pretty sure a bunch of people saw me and it was really embarrassing, but now it's pretty funny. So,
And it's okay if it ever is funny for us, because maybe it was something dangerous. You know, I'm not suggesting everybody laugh at every single thing that happens to you. Of course not.
No.
But, you know, there are those times that when we are, or certain things, we have that same openness and joking. Jenny, you get a lot of personal stories that you share and your guests do. Let's talk about that art itself, being able to find that story. It's fine. You say, okay, I'm comfortable sharing this story. But for you delivering the stories as a person with vision, you know, impairment, is there challenges, and is it challenges with your timing? I like the fact you're telling these stories and sharing them. That is awesome. But it takes that openness and comfort with it. And with doing the podcast, how did you get there?
I think it's a really natural thing to me to just tell it like it is and not really sugarcoat anything. Although there's usually, you know, some kind of positive spin around the story, around the situation. I don't know. I think telling the stories in the way that I do with the funny, positive spin, that's just who I am. And these stories are things that I have been writing down, telling my friends and family for years and years and years. And so I've got this collection of them, and going into creating the podcast, that was the biggest question mark. Like, are other people actually going to find these stories and the way that I tell them? Are they going to find them as funny as my friends and family say they do? And luckily enough, that seems to be the case. So that is just, I don't know, that is just the best thing in life for me. And having such amazing guests on, they are incredible people in their own right. And I think something that makes the podcast, I don't know, it makes it a natural process. Again, I keep saying natural because it doesn't feel like work to me. It just feels like I'm having this really great conversation with this person that I've wanted to meet forever, or this person who I've known and haven't been able to chat with. And so I think we just get into a good convo, and then the stories come out and they tell themselves.
Rumi, do you find people good with you when it comes to sharing those stories, or that you're all right with being that open with people? And you know, did you, before years ago, when the struggle was there to even be noticed that you were vision impaired, mm-hmm. I'm assuming, and they don't have to be blind stories. I'm not even talking that, just storytelling in general.
Has easier? It's always been kind of the way, if you'll take it, even as a coping thing, right? Because sometimes I think that internally we push certain things so down that even things that could easily be just funny stories end up being detrimental to our confidence and to our mental health and to different things like that. So it gets really heavy. And I found that over the years, because me and my mom, we laugh a lot about so many things, that she was the one, especially when I started moving, or when I moved out, I started sharing things that would happen where she wasn't around to see it, but I knew she'd appreciate. And that became kind of the way to catapult into other people knowing about things and just it becoming a story time situation, Jenny, like you're talking about. And honestly, like you, I feel like if we were to write down all the things that have happened over the years that we've shared with, yeah, we'd have a huge pile of stories that we can share. And I think that people could appreciate, and we'd appreciate it doing it internally.
I like the fact you've been writing them, Jenny, and just kind of, you know, hey, that's funny to me. And doing a diary like that, if you want to call it that, or journaling.
You know, what's interesting is every time I have a guest on, almost every time they're like, I, this happens so often. These moments happen so often that I can't even really think of any. They're just my day to day life. So a lot of people will say, oh, I have to go talk to my friends and family, and they'll remind me of my low vision moments.
That's really interesting. And it's true, because I know myself, people will say, remember the time? No. Well, you told me that. Well, no, I don't remember that worth a darn. I don't pay any attention to myself anymore than anyone else does. So it's very interesting, because I think also it's very cathartic to be able to share those stories, whether you ever want to write them, do a story of some kind, or a podcast in your situation. It's also just to sit back, especially if you're feeling funny, because I think your point that it sometimes takes a really long time to be okay with something that happened, especially related to the disability, and you know, something you just think, oh, if I wasn't blind, I wouldn't have done that. And, you know, I wouldn't have made that mistake, or I might have not missed that opportunity because I literally couldn't see it coming by.
Mm. You make such a good point. And I don't know where I'm going with this. This podcast is, all I want to say is, it's like, it is such a selfish thing for me because of the cathartic, the release, you know, all that is very real. Particularly one good example is the episode with Dennis. Dennis Hurley, he's a fantastic actor and comedian who I've looked up to forever. And to have those kinds of conversations that I had with him going into stories from my childhood, where at the time, that stuff was not funny. I was frustrated. I was not having a good time. I was not looking at the lighter side of things. I don't think I ever really had many of those conversations with anybody. And you need to find the right people who you know or you hope are going to relate and be like, yes, that is what I'm relating and that is what I'm talking about. So I think it's such a selfish thing for me, this podcast, because it's cathartic. I get to talk to all these fantastic people. And it's just like the best thing that's happened for me in a long time.
It's funny, Ramya, we've heard other people say that, you know, and I think that's really where a lot of podcasting started. Somebody having an idea, something they wanted to talk about, and they just needed to click, hit record and talk into a mic.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to say that approach, Jenny, feels like, brilliant in and of itself, where you start kind of light, you have that, you say, okay, you know, how much can we talk about on this level? But eventually, if you click on that level, which is the lighter and the funnier and the, you know, this person gets what I'm talking about, you get into such deep conversations, which is why the podcast, though it is funny and though you really do put in those comedic elements, I think people can get a lot more out of it.
Jenny, thank you so much for visiting with us, talking to us a little bit about blindness and, of course, what goes into the podcast and your ability to be open with your guests and crack them and make them feel, hey, man, this is a fun place and free place to share. That's, of course, the Low Vision Moments podcast hosted by Jenny Bovard. Thanks, Jen.
Thank you. This was so much fun. I'd love to come back sometime.
You know you're welcome anytime for the roundtable. We'll talk soon. Good luck at work. And I left a lot of things on the table to talk about. We'll get the other stuff too down the road. Thanks, Jen.
Right on.
Jenny Bovard joining us. We do this on Thursdays right here on Kelly & Company. It is the roundtable. And do check out the podcast. Simply subscribe using your favorite podcatcher. And while you're at it, give her a rating and review. We'll take a break and wrap up our program and see what's up next on Now with Dave Brown in just a moment. Saturday on The Pulse at 10 a.m. Eastern, Joita speaks to Jenny Freeman from the Disability Opportunities Fund about the world's first fully accessible hotel opening in West Virginia next year. Sunday at 10 a.m. Eastern, they speak to the co-authors of We Move Together, a new children's book that talks about disability, difference, and ableism. That's The Pulse this weekend. This weekend on AMI Audio, but also remember, available via podcast. Kelly McDonald, Ramya Muthan. We are the hosts of Kelly & Company, also available via podcast. Rum, what segments do you like?
Well, a few segments came to mind today, but Fern Lullum giving our listeners a little bit of information about a charity that works internationally to prevent and treat eye diseases. The reason why this one stood out to me, Kels, is because we think of what we know as prevalent causes
in
for
our community.
Vision loss. Yes, yeah, in our community here
our
in
part
North
of the
America.
World. Anyway. Yeah,
exactly. And even when, you know, Fern talks about things in the UK, we're like, oh yeah, some of the stuff is very familiar to us, and percentages and numbers and stats. But she talked about things going on in third world countries and developing nations, where it was shocking, very shocking. And this organization does so much to help out. So check that out on the podcast.
I really loved our talk with Jack McCormick, your friend. That guy really covered off some great stuff for us today regarding Blind Square, regarding using the beacons in the hospital setting. And I just keep thinking in my mind how many places we can think of where if people bought into this, such a mall or somewhere like that, and how it could work, including financially, to these businesses and not be too expensive. So really good talk with him. Check it out, ladies and gentlemen, via the Kelly & Company podcast. Let's welcome in producer, one of the producers now with Dave Brown, Mr. Paul Daniel, to tell us what the Friday show looks like over there.
Hey, Kelly. Hey, Ramya. On the Friday news panel, convenes as journalists Megan Gilmore and Michelle McQuigg join Dave Brown to discuss some of the big issues of the week, including gig workers are hoping to qualify for the social safety net as the federal liberals consider updating the decades-old employment insurance system. The panel offer their own suggestions as to what some amendments they'd like to find in a new and improved EI. Entertainment critic Michael McNeely will continue with his Academy Award picks as he discusses the nominees in the Best Female Actor category. And Karen McKay from the Center for Equitable Library Access offers her featured selections with an animal theme, as today is Zoo Lovers Day.
Ooh. Well, that's good to keep in mind.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to just go with Animal Farm, I'm assuming.
I hope maybe. Charlotte's Web, perhaps. You know?
Yeah, there you go. Now, there's one of my favorites.
Okay.
Yep.
Hey. There's the only rat that I don't mind in something, Templeton there. Other than that, but he gets around, especially when they go to the carnival and oh my goodness. I digress. Can you get that on YouTube, Paul? Well, probably.
It's smooth, I digress.
Paul, thanks a lot, pal. Enjoy.
You too. Take care, guys.
We'll talk to that guy again when he's back next week telling us what's going on now with Dave Brown, Ramya Muthan, Kelly McDonald. We are the hosts of Kelly and Company, and we shall return to the airwaves tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern, or like Now with Dave Brown, you can find us available via podcast if you missed their live show at 9 a.m. in the morning here on AMI. Whew. Busy show again today, miss. Mm-hmm. Lots of great stuff, lots of great variety. I think because of all that, you get overwhelmed, so we'll have to make tomorrow a Friday and open the gateway to the weekend.
Why, thank you. That's so kind.
Ridiculous generosity on my part, but it happens all the time. At least once a week, I have to be so
Can you also
generous.
Give us a good weather again?
No.
If you don't
I think
mind.
I'd like, no, I'd like some rain. That's good weather to me. This brightness is killing me. Oh.
Can't ask for too much, right?
Not all the time. Come on. One thing at a time. Talk to you tomorrow at 2.
Okay. Talk tomorrow.
Google's new R toy fulfills the childhood dream of digging a hole to the other side of the earth. John Beeler of the App Show, he has the details on that. A woman from Montreal has designed a new seat so people with disabilities will feel more comfortable when traveling. We find more about that with Karen McGee. Also, Bill Shackleton joins us for the Friday Buzz. On the chatty bookshelf, Ryan Huey discusses the book Thrivers by Michelle Borba, a book following the lives of children during the COVID-19 pandemic. And let's revisit and weigh in on some of the conversations we've had over the last week or two on Cut for Time. We assemble tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern. We'll talk to you then, ladies and gentlemen. Stick around, folks. Late edition. It's up next.
The type of person who firmly will believe that I do not talk in my sleep or scream in my sleep, or even, you know what, I'll go as far as to say I don't move in my sleep. If somebody doesn't tell me that they have absolute evidence, people, absolute evidence that I snore or talk or move in my sleep or grunt or whatever you want to say, you know, the things that people do, I have no idea because I don't do them. When I was younger, my younger brother, who's just 2 years younger than me, he used to sleep talk, sleep walk, sleep put on his shoes, and sleep get ready to go outside and play. We were kids and he was absolutely outdoorsy. So that did happen. I was awake for all of it, most of it at least, because we slept in the same room and he was asleep when I was awake because I would be up very, very late illegally watching TV and stuff like that. So anyway, back to the problem. He was a sleep talker and a sleepwalker, but he was the only one in the family. My youngest brother doesn't do it. As far as I know, I actually don't do it. But it was kind of scary. So I used to think, like, what if I have a little bit of that in me? Just, you know, sleep murmuring maybe. But nobody said anything. So I am here to tell you that if nobody has evidence of me snoring or sleep talking, then I probably just don't do it. And I've honestly never had reason to believe so. I mean, I've lived with roommates, I've lived with my family, and I just, nobody's really taken a recording. So that's that, hopefully.
You've been listening to the complete Kelly and Company podcast experience.
The Real Deal airs weekdays from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern on AMI Audio. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast platform.